Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the PFC Podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC Podcast. This is Dennis, and today I'm with Steve. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. Perfect. So I had heard through the grapevine that you are doing a calcium study, and by perchance, I wanted to do a podcast on calcium, so I thought you'd be the guy to talk to.
Okay. Good coincidence.
So stop teasing me. If you would, would you mind starting off, one, introduce yourself, and then we can jump into tell me about your trial.
Okay. So my name is Steve Schauer. I'm an active duty lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. I am currently at the University of Colorado, Denver, doing a critical care fellowship. And I previously did my emergency medicine residency at the Berkheimer Medical Center. Spent a couple years out at Fort Polk, and then I spent a little over 8 years at the Army Institute of Surgical Research, where I was primarily involved in research range anywhere from clinical stuff to clinical translational and all the way back to the lab. And then I'm out here now at the fellowship. So we started a clinical study a number of years ago, looking at the effects of trauma on calcium levels across three centers, which I think we're primarily going to talk about today. And I'm also happy to say that we've actually finished enrollment for the study. And now we just have, a massive undertaking of getting all the data out that we need. But I'm happy the study is done. We exceeded our enrollment goals, and hopefully I'll be presenting some of that to some future conferences once we have all the data pulled.
Perfect, perfect. I got to be honest, since Ricky Ditzel did the last paper on it, I haven't heard much of anything about a real study about calcium and its usefulness in trauma.
So first of all, it's impossible to talk calcium and military trauma without talking about Ricky. There's one guy who on calcium is definitely him. So he had a really good paper he put out a number of years ago. I think it was in JTACs, if I remember right. Just talking about how, calcium kind of plays into what we previously called the lethal triad. Now there's also the lethal diamond, lethal quartet, a couple other things that were named that included calcium in that. So that was definitely one of the things that kind of, prompted a lot of the discussion about calcium. We had a study that we submitted for grant funding. I think it was back maybe in 2019 or 2020. And then, with all the funding cycles, the way everything works, it typically takes anywhere from a year, 18 months before the study actually gets off the ground. So right now we're in about year three of the actual study. And we've wrapped up enrollment, and now we're just getting all the data out that we need from the enrollment from the study.
Perfect. Perfect. So, if you wouldn't mind to start kind of walking me through, what is the main question, I guess, that we're asking with this study?
So the main question we're trying to ask this study is, how many patients come in with a calcium arrangement, a calcium derangement on arrival to the trauma center as a result of the trauma in and of itself? So we're trying to determine, before we start pouring blood products in and all kinds of other things that can throw off their calcium levels, how many of them are coming in with some sort of calcium derangement just from getting mangled up in and of itself? So the study is taking place at three different trauma centers, all three level one trauma centers, the Berkheimer Medical Center, which is the DOD's only level one trauma center, and also it's a public trauma center that takes trauma from all across the southwest region of Texas. The University of Texas Health San Antonio, which is the other trauma center right across the other side of San Antonio, another big receiving level one trauma center. And then the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, University of Colorado Hospital is the third one, another level one trauma center that takes trauma from all across the region and actually multiple states around Colorado.
Okay, perfect. And I imagine, trauma in DOD is generally pretty bad. Do you think there's a fair enough correlation between civilian traumas and military traumas?
That is always the number one challenge when doing, clinical trials or clinical studies here in the U.S. And then trying to extrapolate them to the deployed setting. Certainly deployed setting, we have gunshot wounds. And here in the U.S., we have gunshot wounds. I would tell you they're not exactly the same. I mean, when you're downrange, you're getting hit with high power rounds. Here, typically you get hit with pistol rounds, maybe shotgun rounds. It's very rare that somebody's getting hit with a high power round. So they're both gunshot wounds, but they're not exactly the same. The area that's really different is the fact that we have a ton of motor vehicle trauma here. There is a fair amount of motor vehicle trauma downrange, but by far and away, one of the most common injury mechanisms we've had, at least in the last two conflicts, were explosives, which we just don't see here. And explosive trauma is like this weird conglomeration of both like blunt and penetrating and crush trauma all at the same time. So there's always that limitation with any type of research we do here in the U.S. and trying to extrapolate it to the deployed setting is that we just don't have the exact same mechanisms of injury. And we're trying to find the best, comparator we can, but it's not the same.
Yeah. And so I guess, would you correlate that with like an injury severity score or I guess, how would you kind of map that out?
So I'll tell you the DODTR uses injury severity score. The National Trauma Registry uses injury severity score, but the injury severity score is not a good score for military trauma. In fact, it's not even a great injury score for just gunshot wounds in general. ISS was originally created by automobile companies to assess trauma after motor vehicle accidents. So if you look at some of the ISS scoring, there's some weird things about it that just don't quite translate. So for instance, if you had a gunshot wound that goes through, both hemispheres of your head, but doesn't actually hit the brainstem, it's still only an ISS of one or two. We all know that if you have a gunshot wound that goes straight through your head like this, that's universally fatal. So there's definitely some flaws that are within the ISS. But that said, it's probably one of the better scoring systems we have available, and certainly one of the most widely used ones. Now some people have developed, military-specific ones, but then the question is how you take that military-specific one and then try and apply it to civilian trauma is also hard. So there's a little bit of language mismatch that's happening here in terms of some of your injury severity score. But for now, that's kind of the best we have.
Yeah. All right. Well, use what you got, right? So also, I would imagine, you're talking about, patient on arrival to the ER, right? We're starting to get our I-STATs drawing our calciums, and we're going to follow them at some kind of interval throughout their stay. Pre-hospital, I would imagine, is going to affect that value in some way, either with crystalloids or some systems, they do pre-hospital blood. Are you going to have to kind of, filter that out or categorize that in a special way? So that I can get consistent numbers across the board. I don't know if that makes sense, but
it does. There's several different ways we can try and account for that. So first of all, there's some natural variability between the sites. So UT Health San Antonio and BAMC, also in San Antonio, as a lot of people are probably aware, San Antonio has like a very robust pre-hospital whole blood program, probably the best in the country. And so there's a fair number of patients that are going to come in that are going to receive some product before they get to the ED. We knew that going into this. And obviously you can't, withhold product from somebody pre-hospital that's hypotense just in the name of trying to get their calcium level on arrival. So, we have to work with the limitations of the system we're in and within, some ethical boundaries as well. And so we already know coming in that some of the patients are going to receive blood, but it's typically going to be very minimal. It's very unusual for a patient to get more than one unit pre-hospital before they arrive. So at most, they're going to have maybe one unit in. And we're still going to have a ton of patients that were brought in by trucks that may not have necessarily had blood on the truck. So we can certainly separate out the two groups. That's very easy to do. You just simply look at them and you say, okay, this group here got one unit or two units of pre-hospital whole blood. This group here didn't. Is really been a big difference between these two groups, which is probably an important question to figure out exactly how much that pre-hospital whole blood really has an effect on calcium. So that's one question right there we're going to answer just by comparing those two groups. The second thing is that, at least here in Denver, where I'm at now, the University of Colorado, the system here, they don't yet have a pre-hospital whole blood program. They're going to have one here pretty soon, but it's not a matter of routine that they're receiving blood products pre-hospital. So you're also going to have some natural variability between the sites and the fact that San Antonio has the, you know, very large one of the first whole blood programs pre-hospital, and then here they haven't yet launched it. And by the time they launch it, our enrollment's going to be done because our enrollment finished up last month or so. So we're going to have some natural variability between the sites for when you're going to, you know, have patients getting calcium, patients not getting calcium. So you're going to have, we should have plenty of people in both groups to get good comparisons and give you actual good numbers between those two. There's also statistical methods you can use to kind of adjust for those units of blood they've received and make an estimate based on the adjustment as to what their calcium level probably would have been had they not received that unit of blood.
Okay. Now, you know, that's definitely pre-hospital. Once they get into hospital, you know, I don't know how popular or how broadly used whole blood is versus component therapy. I know we've been talking about, you know, the benefits of whole blood, but I don't know how far that's spread out through civilian medicine. You know, when you're, especially when you're talking about component therapy, like the citrate levels are going to be a lot different. The amount of colloid or crystalloid is going to be different just because, you know, they're adding it to each of those components. So, I mean, is there a way that you're going to have a third column where they got pre-hospital blood, and then once they get to hospital, they're getting component therapy or they're getting whole blood, and that stuff, I would imagine, is going to get hard to track after a while.
So the way we're doing the draws for this study, and this is the prospective study, so we were able to control when the blood draws happen. So the most important blood draw we're going to have is the blood draw as soon as they hit the trauma bay before they get any blood products. So if they don't already have vascular access and we can't get vascular access, we're about to start pouring product through an IO. All three of the sites are basically using a direct fem stick just to get blood real quick. So we're going to have blood before the blood products start going in. So the only blood that they would have that would potentially affect our primary question we're trying to answer, which is their calcium level on arrival, is if they got it pre-hospital. Now what we're doing as well as a secondary outcome is we're looking at calcium levels throughout the first 24 hours of their hospital stay. So roughly every 6 hours, we're getting a blood draw that's going to happen over the course of the 24 hours. So from the time of arrival, before they get any product, through the 24 hours that we're pouring product and crystalloid and calcium and TXA and all kinds of other stuff in, we're going to plot out their calcium values in relation to all the other things they've gotten in terms of timing, in terms of dosing, and how often they have, you know, major fluctuations in terms of the relation to those interventions. So that is going to be a little more of a little more complex statistical analysis to account for all those things and look at how they interact with each other. Because really what we're trying to figure out is how all these pieces kind of interact with each other in terms of the physiology. So, I mean, we think we know that pouring blood product in causes their calcium to go down. We don't really know how much it happens. And also, you know, a lot of the measurements and stuff that the assessments have been done have been in very limited aliquots of blood. We don't know what's happening when you have this giant mess of, like, product and whole blood and crystalloid all get poured in at once. And then some calcium chaser and all kinds of other stuff. So what we're really trying to assess is how all those different things are going to interact with each other in terms of your calcium levels and certainly in terms of your outcomes. But like I said, our primary outcome is really looking at that arrival calcium, which we'll have before any product starts going in, at least from us.
Okay. All right. Perfect. Because I imagine, you know, when you're replacing that person's blood volume two or three times over with a major trauma, probably going to throw off what their normal numbers are, I would guess.
Yep. And then certainly you're going to have other things happening there, like tissue ischemia and tissue reperfusion and all those things that we don't necessarily know how it's going to affect the calcium. Once it interacts with the blood that we're pouring in, which, oh, by the way, this blood is of, you know, varying age and also coming from a bunch of different donors who are all different, you know, health status and all kinds of things that factor into how blood works once it gets inside of you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right. Now, how many people or patients are you expecting to collect in order to finally say, like, okay, like, we have enough numbers?
So that's a little bit of a complex question. So initially, when we had designed this study, we had anticipated that we were going to be able to get our calcium values on arrival and then our calcium values all throughout that 24 hours. It turned out that getting the calcium values in the ED and the trauma bays immediately upon arrival was actually very easy to do, but getting the calcium levels as they go throughout the course of 24 hours was actually much more complicated than what we thought it was going to be. So from a study logistical perspective, that was actually a lot harder than what we anticipated. So we had anticipated we were going to roll, I think, somewhere around like 420 patients, I think. And we thought we were going to have calcium levels for all those people throughout the 24 hours. It turned out that, like I said, it was harder than what we thought logistically to get all those draws. So because of that, we actually had to overshoot our sample size in terms of our primary outcome. So in terms of the patients that have an arrival calcium before getting any blood, I think our final numbers are going to be somewhere around the range of like 900-ish, maybe a little more. Then the patients that have the vast majority of their 24-hour draws is going to be over 400. So in terms of the 24-hour plot, we're going to have over 400 that have the majority of their calcium draws. We're going to have, like I said, somewhere over 900 in terms of the arrival calciums is what we're targeting right now. Yeah.
Okay. But that's the main question anyway, is how many coming in hypocalcemic or eucalcemic or whatever, right? Okay.
So the other thing we could talk about as well is we do have some data set that's under review right now from the DODTR that's under review with the journal. I'm not going to say the journal name because it hasn't been accepted yet. But I do want to point out that, I mean, there is some data from downrange suggesting that, calcium derangements do happen. And I can, share some of that data with you now just to kind of give you an idea of the fact that there is some, data from downrange suggesting that calcium derangements do happen. And I'll pull up some of the numbers for you here right now. So it looked like here that we had out of the roughly 2,000 draws, over half of them had a calcium derangement when they came in to the emergency department. And these are mostly emergency department draws that we're looking at. And the number of patients that had them above and below was quite a bit. It wasn't just patients that had, just low calcium. So let me pull up the numbers for you here. So what we did is we looked at the association of the hyper and hypocalcemia. The patients that came in high, patients that came in low. There was more patients that came in low than patients that came in high, but there was a substantial number of patients that came in high. We looked at a whole bunch of different outcomes, or I should say associations, not necessarily outcomes. We looked at INR, thrombocytopenia, acidosis, drops in hemoglobin, tachycardia, hypotension, shock and disease, hypothermia, and then the number of patients that went on to receive what we call a submassive transfusion, or at least 3 units of packed cells or whole blood, supermassive transfusions and massive transfusions. And hypercalcemia was associated with nearly all of those. Hypocalcemia was associated with as well. But in terms of the association, we found there was a stronger association between hypercalcemia versus hypocalcemic events for nearly all of them, except for about 2 of the measurements. But in terms of like your physiologic derangements, tachycardia, hypotension, being high or having high calcium was actually more associated with that than what it was having low calcium in terms of the derangements. So again, that's just some retrospective data from downrange. There's a whole bunch of limitations that come with using DODTR data in terms of actually knowing the timing of events and stuff like that. So at best, we can say maybe there's some associations, but I was just going to share some of that data as well that will be coming out a lot sooner than what our prospective calcium study will. I think our prospective calcium study we're hoping to have under review by about the end of this calendar year.
Okay. And I mean, especially in DOD, like our documentation pre-hospital is not the greatest. And so I imagine
I would say in a hospital it's better, but it's not that much better. Really the main thing we lack a lot of good timing data. We know that certain things happen in the ED, certain things happen in the OR, or certain things happen in the ICU, but where exactly they happen in relation to each other is not always clear. You can spend a lot of time in the ED doing a resuscitation before they even leave to go to the OR. In that 15 minutes, there's a lot of stuff that can happen, and a lot of stuff that can go wrong, a lot of stuff that, a lot of interventions you can do. And so understanding exactly where stuff happened in that 15 minutes can be often difficult to do, which, again, is one of the reasons why we're doing the prospective study, is to have much better timing data.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of getting things done, with DCR, and I'm going through the damage control, resuscitation, and prolonged field care, CPG is what I'm looking at. They mentioned giving calcium with your whole blood, not delaying blood to give calcium, but hopefully going in at the same time. They mentioned 30 mLs of calcium gluconate, 10 mLs of calcium chloride. Now, if you happen to look at the vial, both of them say 1 gram. So why on earth would I give calcium gluconate when I can have 3 times the power in calcium chloride and I'm still given 1 gram? So I don't actually understand why is there a difference, and why not just give calcium chloride?
Well, I mean, the main limitation is that calcium chloride you generally want to give through a central line or some sort of central venous access. You can get a lot of like phlebitis, and if you get extravasation with that version, you can also cause a lot of tissue necrosis. So there's more risk to it. And also, by the way, a lot of times you don't have central venous access, so it's a little bit easier just to get the calcium gluconate. The reason why you're giving 3 times the amount is just because one has more ionized than the other one. Because, when it's in its form where it's bound, it's not the active form. It needs to basically decouple and be in the ionized form for it to be active. But the calcium gluconate, you have to give 3 times as much because it doesn't have as much ionized calcium in it once it dissociates compared to the calcium chloride.
Okay. So don't pay attention to the 1 gram on the vial. It's the volume that you're actually looking for.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, so really, you can think of it more as the concentration once it actually enters your body.
Yeah.
As opposed to, they're not necessarily equal when they're in their stored formulation.
Okay. Perfect. Now, I am in a soft unit, and if I'm going to give something to someone, I'm going to give it as rapidly as I possibly can because we're extreme. So. I like to push my calcium as rapidly as I possibly can. But since this is a medical education podcast, how probably should I be giving it?
Slower is better. I mean, whenever you push the calcium, you got to keep in mind it's going to have effect on all the cardiomyocytes. So like rapid fluctuations and stuff like that can cause, dysrhythmias, which are probably temporary. But for the most part, you probably like to avoid that as much as you can as somebody that's already hemodynamically unstable. So the slower you can give, the better, In terms of options, there's always the option to drip it in, but there's also the option to do a slow push, say over like 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes. That's going to give you a lot less fluctuation and give your body some time to acclimate and for it to disseminate throughout your blood volume, as opposed to like one rapid push, like you're giving adenosine and trying to get, all 1 gram of the heart, within 17 seconds, is going to have different effects. So, it's slower is better, is what I would suggest.
Okay. Now, obviously, you want to jump to blood as rapidly as possible because that's what's going to save somebody's life. I've seen guys are rapid to calcium. I've seen guys that are rapid to TXA. How fast should I be giving it? I guess not administering it, but in this continuum of care, how important is giving calcium, which I guess is the purpose of your study? But just in good medical care, is it something that as soon as I start the blood, go ahead and get some other point of access and start administering calcium and TXA, or is it something like get to it when you get to it?
I would not venture to say you need calcium with your first unit of blood. Ideally you're doing this at some place where you have an ISTAT available, so you at least get some idea as to what the trend is happening with your calcium, but I get that ISTATs are not available everywhere. Although, with the portability and all that, I think they should be pushed further forward, especially if you're in an area that's expecting casualties, in an area that's storing large volumes of blood product. I'm not sure if you're storing large volumes of blood product, why you can't have an ISTAT machine. So, that's one question I would always pose when it comes to that. The hard part about calcium is that we don't really know who is dipping down to that hypocalcemic range and who may be in that hypercalcemic range. Most of the data seems to be centered around this like Goldilocks concept where you want, not too little, but not too much. Mm-hmm. Too little and too much are also a bad thing. It's not necessarily one of those things where, if some is good, more must be better when it comes to calcium. I think most of the data so far, and probably what our data is going to show, is that keeping them within that sweet spot of like a normal calcium is where you get the optimum physiologic benefit. At some point, you're going to fall off the back end of that cliff. And you're going to start losing the benefit as you start to push more calcium in. The problem is that we don't really know who those people are just by looking at them. There's not like a calcium oximeter, like a pulse oximeter, where you just put the thing on their finger and it tells you, in real time what their calcium is. Right. So that's one of the underlying challenges is that, you know, if you just take a guess and you're giving calcium with every single unit of blood you're giving them, there's a chance that you may be pouring more calcium or more gas to fire with somebody that's already hypercalcemic. Also, you know, with 1 unit of blood, I'm not sure 1 unit of blood is going to cause your calcium level to drop significantly enough that you need to be pushing calcium in with every single one. There was a systematic review that I posted a couple months ago that came back out in February. They looked at calcium derangements, all the studies that were available looking at calcium derangements on arrival to the trauma bay and comparing the patients that got blood pre-hospital versus ones that didn't. And the difference was like 0.03, millimoles per liter. It was a very small amount. It wasn't much. So it wasn't like the little bit of blood they're getting pre-hospital was causing these, you know, substantial drops in calcium that are going to cause all kinds of physiologic derangements. So I think it's probably a bit on the aggressive end to say that for every unit of blood you're pouring, you should be pouring in calcium just empirically. And certainly, like I said, if you're pouring in a few units of blood or at a place where you have a pretty substantial supply of blood, you should probably be asking your chain of command to also give you a stat machine so you can be measuring that in real time or as close to real time as you possibly can as you're pouring stuff in.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely right. You know, if you're able to actually do a massive transfusion, you probably should have the lab equipment. Since you have the coolers to store all this blood, you probably have enough room for an I-STAT machine.
Especially because they're so small. I mean, yeah, the cartridges have to be stored a special way, but if you have the refrigerator to store the blood, you can store the cartridges. And the I-STAT machines are like, they're smaller than like the old school, you know, Zach Moore cell phone. I mean, that's how small they are now. So they're not very big. So certainly like a portable thing. It's not like you're asking people to carry around some TEG machine with them or something like that, you know, where it requires an entire desk or something.
Yeah. You know, and at least in the prolonged field care CPG, it's not, you know, you're not giving calcium with every unit. It's every 2 to 4 units, at least consider giving calcium. And I'm guessing the assumption is that they're hypocalcemic, but that's the question of your study is, are they actually, you know?
Another thing you can be doing too is you certainly got to be reassessing your patient during that time. I mean, so if you're looking at your patient, you're saying, you know, I've given them blood for how much they've been bleeding. This blood should have had an effect, and they're still like hypotense and still having hemodynamic, you know, derangement, stuff like that. Then you may want to consider giving the calcium and basically doing your own little mini clinical trial and see what happens. You know, if you give an amycalcium and their hemodynamics start to improve, and again, you don't feel like there's ongoing bleeding, okay, maybe you're down the right track. But, you know, I surely don't think the answer is, well, you know, I see some hemodynamic instability. I'm going to pour like, you know, 6 vials of this stuff in. So it's something where you're going to have to constantly, like, you know, you may have to do it, reassess, if you don't have the machines available to do it. But I think the big thing is you're going to have to kind of make your clinical assessment about, you know, ongoing bleeding, how much blood you've given, and, you know, make those frequent reassessments and decide whether you're going down the right track or not, at least based on some physiologic feedback you're getting.
Yeah. So, you know, at least what I've seen when I'm doing I wouldn't call it DCR because it's really like 1 or 2 units, so some blood anyway, and you know, especially if that patient is like really crashing, like they're starting to lose radials, like we are danger close to actually just losing vital signs altogether, and I've given a gram of calcium, I've used calcium chloride. I just make sure that I have a good IV with a solid flush, and if I don't see their tissue balloon up, then I'm assuming it's going through. So I go ahead and I push the calcium. I push it in that situation. I push it pretty aggressively. And I've seen them bounce back. I wouldn't say, amazing vital signs, but definitely amazing compared to the none that they had before. and that last seems to last me roughly about 10 minutes. And that is definitely enough time that I can, get my blood started and start crushing that in to actually help the situation, actually get things moving forward, right? So, you know, that's the effect I've seen, you know, giving calcium. But hypercalcemia, like, are there any physiologic signs that I should be looking for that would tell me, you know, he might be too high? Or am I just doing a test dose of a gram of calcium, and if things get worse, stop doing that?
Yeah, if you don't have the machines available, that's a tough one. I mean, I think if you don't have machines available, you're going to have to make your assessment as to, you know, how much blood you're pouring in, how much blood you think they're losing, and then you're probably going to have your own little mini clinical trial and see what happens, your trial, your N-of-1 trial, and see what happens. You know, if you give the calcium and you don't think there's necessarily, you know, significant ongoing hemorrhage, and all of a sudden the hemodynamics start to go back, you know, off the back end there, then maybe you overshot it with the calcium. That's a tough one, though, because without being able to measure it, you're taking your best guess. I think that's about all you can do. You know, certainly in terms of IV access, you know, first of all, you use what you got when you have available, both in terms of your drugs and your IV access. Okay. You know, if you have an IV that you're comfortable pushing D50 in, you're probably okay to push the calcium chloride in as well. You know, that not the official recommendation, but, you know, again, use what you got to make your best judgment. And if you're looking at an IV and you have a big one to AC and you're saying to yourself, yeah, I'd have no problem pushing some D50 in there, you probably have no issue pushing the calcium chloride in there.
I never actually pushed D50, so I have no idea what that is, but I have taken a solid, you know, 10cc flush and just hard slam it. And like if a tissue balloons up,
a cold swollen or not, yeah.
Then if I don't have that, then it's probably pretty solid.
Yeah. And your other option always too is IO as well. I mean, you can put a lot of stuff through IO just because the nature of how those vessels work.
Okay. Yes. Which actually leads me to a question. So extravasation can lead to tissue damage. I'm putting it into a bone. That's not getting absorbed super quick into the vas. Well, it is, but it isn't. It's going directly into tissue, getting picked up. Is that going to cause necrosis?
Well, if your IO is in the right spot, and it's actually in the bone marrow, which is like highly vascularized, no, you shouldn't really have any issues. Again, not sure I would slam it in. The only challenge with IOs is sometimes you do get IO misplacement. Which can happen. So you can certainly have IOs that are in like muscle tissue, or they can become dislodged and get muscle tissue as you're moving the patient. So you just want to make sure that you're actually in the bone compartment there when you're pushing the stuff, and that it hasn't dislodged with the soft tissue. I mean, the real issue is when you start pushing this stuff in the soft tissue. It's not necessarily when you start pushing it into the marrow, which is highly vascularized.
Okay. All right. Perfect. You know, say I'm a brand new person, brand new medic, and I'm trying to filter out what exactly do you want me to do. What advice would you have as far as administration of calcium?
It's going to first boil down to use what you got. So it depends on which one you got. You know, if you have the calcium gluconate, you have the calcium chloride. You know, if it's unlikely you're going to be having, you know, good vascular access, or you're not quite sure about your phlebotomy skills and stuff like that, then maybe stick with the calcium gluconate when you're loading up your aid bag. You know, if you have a whole bunch of IOs with you and you're very confident in your vascular access, you know, maybe you can push for some calcium chloride, because certainly it's less volume you have to carry around. And, you know, volume is always one of the limiting factors in how much stuff you can pack. So it's going to be a little bit of, you know, assessment of that. But I think a lot of that's probably going to be dictated by your supply chain and what you can get a hold of. I mean, at least my experience downrange is that the supply chain, it wasn't like, you know, you're shopping at Walmart where you get to choose whatever you want. It's basically like you're going to, you know, the corner gas station and you get to choose, you know, from the limited stuff they have available. And that's what you get. So that's probably going to dictate more than anything what you're going to be carrying, is what your, you know, logisticians are going to get you.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And generally, it seems like no medical direction whatsoever goes into what the logisticians give you. Cool. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
You still want to talk about the TXA?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the question, that's a good question. And this is always like, you know, a hard one to answer, which is you brought up three things. You brought up the blood, you brought up the TXA, you brought up the calcium, and you're like, okay, I've only got so much time here, and there's, you know, only one of me, and there's, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 casualties. How do I prioritize those things? And, you know, assuming you have an unlimited supply of all three of those things, which is also another factor, and a whole different discussion when it comes to, you know, triaging resources. Let's say you have unlimited access to all three of those things. I would certainly say you want to prioritize your blood, number one.
Sure.
Your blood is going to restore the physiology. It's going to give it the coagulation factors. It's going to, you know, help them with delivery of oxygen to the tissues. So blood is number one. There's tons of data supporting that.
Really?
Definitely reach for your blood for number one. Now, I would tell you reach for your TXA for number two. So your TXA is going to stop the fibrinolysis, which is basically the breakdown of clots as they form. And this is like a normal physiologic function, except when you have a massive injury and you're pouring blood out, you start to get, you know, more fibrinolysis than what you want. And you almost kind of fall into this area of what people call hyperfibrinolysis, which is a lot of fibrinolysis where you're breaking down all kinds of clots that you don't want broken down. And TXA basically stops that from happening in terms of the fiber breakdown. So the TXA is going to help reduce the amount of your own clots that are getting broken down by, you know, coagulopathy and your coagulation derangements. So I would put that as number two, because what you don't want to do is you don't want to have all those clots form and then have all the clots get broken down, and then your own coagulation factors are basically like gone, which TXA will help slow that down. Now, there's always a question of how you administer TXA. You know, certainly there's the 2 gram flush option, and I would tell you that, you know, 2 gram flush of TXA is better than no gram flush of TXA. If you have the time and you have the resources and the ability to do it, I think the standard infusion plus the drip is going to be the best option. So there's relatively good data showing, you know, we need to reach certain concentrations of TXA in your blood before you get the antifibrinolysis activity. And so it's only going to have an effect as long as you're above that level. And I posted about this a while back, but it kind of gets into a bunch of pharmacokinetics. But unless you're above that level, the TXA is not going to have an effect. So if you have this quick bolus that goes way up and then way down, you don't get quite as much time in the antifibrinolysis. So if you have the time and the resources, and you can do the infusion followed by the drip, what you do is you bring it up above that level, and then you sustain it like this way, 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 way out here. So you have a long period of time that you're in the antifibrinolysis range, which is where we want to stay. So, you know, again, 2 grams is better than no grams, but if you have the ability to set up the infusion plus the bolus, I think that's going to be a better option. And all of the major clinical trials right now at least support that, because nobody's done a big clinical trial looking at, you know, just flush options. But there's also a lot of logistical benefits to the flush, which is that it's, you know, a lot easier to do, and, you know, people are more likely to do things that are easier, quicker, faster, as opposed to things that are like a major pain in the butt, which is what the infusion plus the bolus is. That's a major pain in the butt, especially by yourself. So I would put that as number two. And then as you're going down your list, I think, you know, thinking yourself some of the calcium derangements as your important product and stuff like that is probably a little further down the list. But those are the things you want to be doing up front, I think, is your big thing, is your blood, your TXA. And as you're starting to stabilize out, you're starting to get down your algorithm, you can start thinking about giving things like calcium. But I certainly wouldn't put that as my number one thing. So, you know, working on my cash today, I don't think the number one thing I'm going to do is whip out some calcium and start pouring that in before I do all those other things.
Yes. Obviously, I think it depends on what do you have immediately available. Like if your blood is in a cooler with Steve and he's bouncing around the battlefield, get your access and start with, I would say, either calcium or TXA. Because at least my understanding was, you know, you have trauma, the lethal triad or diamond or pentagram or whatever we're calling it now is starting to set in, right? You have the coagulopathy, you have the acidosis, you have the hypothermia, and calcemia is a question mark. Those are all inhibiting your ability to make clots. Okay. At least this is how I thought it was. Okay. So if I'm not making clots because of these three reasons, then what is TXA doing? Like, I understand it's a hyperfibrinolytic, but if I'm not making a clot, there's nothing to hyperfibrinolate.
Yeah. So that's a good question, because if you're not making clots, then the TXA is not going to do anything. It's not going to stop the clots from getting broken down that were never there in the first place. But one of the main reasons why you'd be giving calcium in the setting of trauma is that calcium is a cofactor with a lot of your coagulation cascade. So if you have no coagulation factors to even make the clot to begin with, the calcium is not going to help your coagulation cascade because you don't have one. So it's just like the same circular thing that if you're out of coagulation factors, the calcium is not going to help you with that. But if you're out of coagulation factors, you're also not going to have, you know, fibrinolysis because there's no fiber forming. But you know, the reason why you get the TXA is to stop your stuff from being exhausted. So, you know, there's kind of like when somebody's bleeding, it's like you're pouring blood in them and they're bleeding out the other side. Ideally, you want to stop them from bleeding out the hole first.
Damn chicken and the
that's
egg.
That's the most important thing. And that's kind of what I would equate your TXA to. If you have all your clots that are forming there, then your clots are getting broken down or falling out the hole here. It's better to stop that hole from getting all the things falling out than it is necessarily to kind of keep pouring stuff on the top of it. So I'm not sure if that was necessarily the best comparison, but you know, if you can stop the bad stuff from happening, it's easier than having to fix the bad stuff after it's happened. Which I think kind of really is where calcium is coming in, is you're trying to fix in the bad stuff that's already happening.
Yes. So the way I thought of it, and again, I could be absolutely completely wrong, is because calcium was part of that clotting cascade, I would be more likely to make clots, as well as helping the cardiovascular system as well as helping the vascular system, et cetera, et cetera. And then hopefully building something so that the TXA would now be able to act on something was my thought process. Am I even in the right ballpark?
I mean, it makes sense what you're saying. I just don't know if there's any data necessarily to support it. Now, there is also a DOD-funded trial that is either launched or it's going to be launching soon. I'd have to check. It's going to be launched out of Pittsburgh. They're leading it through the LIGHTS Network. And part of that is going to be patients are getting one of the arms is they're getting vasopressin. Another arm is they're getting calcium empirically. So that study will actually answer some of that question. Now, it doesn't give you an answer right now today. So, you know, what to do tomorrow, stick to your best knowledge of, physiology. But that will answer some of that stuff as we see what happens in this randomized control trial where they're actually just empirically giving calcium to see what happens. So it may turn out that empirically giving calcium, helps with coagulopathy and they have less bleeding when they get to the hospital. May turn out that it does absolutely nothing. But, until we have the data, it's really hard to get a good answer on that. But I think that trial is going to kind of answer your question, which is, is pouring calcium in, is that going to help me make my clotting cascade work a little bit harder, which I think is what you're asking.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that I'm right. That's the most important part of anything is as long as I'm right, then I'm happy.
There is certainly a physiologic basis for what you're saying, which is the reason why they're doing the randomized control trial. Yeah, nobody's going to go into a multi-million dollar randomized control trial just based on, a whim.
Yeah.
There's physiologic reasons behind it. So, I think certainly in terms of our physiologic understanding, I think you're, in agreement with all the trials happening.
Good. No, hopefully it happens soon. Because I'd hate to think I've been telling people to do things backwards for a long time. So,
if you have never been telling people to do things backwards for a very long time, then it means you probably just haven't been in medicine long enough. Because there's so many things that change over the years. And then the flip side of that is if you've been doing the same thing your entire career, you probably got to be asking yourself, am I out of date here on something I'm doing?
Yeah.
That's the thing about medicine is everything keeps changing. So there's stuff that, I taught our residents 7-8 years ago that I wouldn't even think about teaching now. Yeah. Stuff I learned in residency that I'm like, man, that was crazy when you used to do that.
Yeah. Well, like you said, everything keeps evolving, right?
Yep.
Now, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I appreciate you having me. Like I said, I'm hoping we'll have some data, under review by the end of this year. Certainly, if you invite me back, I'm happy to come talk about it once I actually have the data in hand. And I can give you some much more concrete numbers. I'm happy to share those with you guys. I know you have a very large audience of the people that I am trying to reach with this data. So the more people I can get this data out to, the better. I know that not everyone wants to, dive into the deep rabbit hole of PubMed every time they're answering a question.
Yeah, so perfect.
If I can get this out on either podcasts or social media to the audience I'm looking for, which is, all the people that follow you. But the more, the better.
Yeah, perfect. Well, Steve. Thank you very much for coming on and walking me through this.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Our boy is waiting there for you.